we've always been reading through Luke's gospel most of this, all the semester, and it's been one long series of seeing Jesus Christ march toward the cross to give his life for his enemies. And in this way, you see the love of God just revealed to us. This is what God is like. Despite opposition, he goes and dies for those who are against him. It teaches us about what it means to love. It teaches us about what God is like toward us. It comforts us that despite everything that's gone on, as much as we are against him, he is still giving himself for us. This week, it's a little bit of a pause week, and we shift our eyes off Jesus Christ momentarily to the apostles who we're going to take on after he's gone. It's a leadership transition week. There's lots of leadership transition theory. Any business students here? Studies in management. Yeah, you still. Yeah. Lots of management. You can go to business school and learn all about how to succession plan, how to prep the next generation for taking over from this to the CEO role. There's various models. There's various case studies as to how to do it. One of the case studies I really like is in Stark Enterprises, where Pepper is made the CEO out of desperation because Iron Man has just lost it and everything's falling apart around him. And in desperation, Pepper, you've got to take over because I can't do it. I'm too busy running around in my suit to be able to look after the company as well. And of course, the succession plan there all comes tumbling down when Pepper dies in Iron Man 3, giving birth to Junior Stark, who takes over from the 4. And,
did you just wreck it?
Yeah, he did.
It's not released.
I forgot to say
I'm going to see it tomorrow night.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. I don't know, it's not released till midnight. I'm married with 4 kids. I haven't seen a movie in about 5 years. I wouldn't know what's going on. If any of that's true, come and tell me tomorrow. Going to the midnight screening.
Tomorrow on Anzac.
Yeah, I think there's a midnight screening. 12 o'clock or who's someone's going to that?
Yeah, it's
This passage today is Jesus' big succession planning speech. We saw last week where he's being betrayed and he's going to go. And this week we see how he sets up the guys to take over from him when he is gone. It's his big succession planning speech. And if you take one line away today, it's this line, that to be a leader or to be great, Jesus tells us, trust God as you suffer for everyone else's sake. That's what Jesus teaches in his succession planning speech to his apostles who will take over after him. You guys, I'm about to go. When I'm gone, trust God as you suffer for everyone else's sake. This is Jesus' management leadership 101. How to lead and be great in this world is to trust God as you go suffering for everyone else's sake. It works in life when you become a parent. You'll be there trusting God as you're suffering for the sake of your kids. For the blokes, as you're a husband, trust God as you're suffering for the sake of your wife and your family. When all of you become youth group leaders or Sunday school leaders at church, elders at church, in those roles, trust God as you suffer there for everyone else's sake. Managers in your companies, it'll happen quicker than you realise. CEO, maybe a little bit longer, but some of you will be there. In those roles in your workplaces, as a leader at the top of the pile, what you're doing there, trust God as you are suffering for everyone else's sake. Mothers will do the same for their kids. Bible study group leaders here, you're doing the same thing for those who come to your group. You trust God as you suffer for everyone else's sake in your group. Youth group leaders, team leaders, through life in the many and various roles that we all will have together and in the places that we go, face life trusting God as you suffer and carry the load for everyone else's sake below you. The passage today spells it out in three sections. We'll just look at those sections first, and then I've got a few reflections for us on what it means to be great, what it means to be a leader. The passage we can divide into three sections, verses 24 to 27. You can put one word next to those. 24, it's the principle of greatness, or the principle of leadership. We see that laid out for us in verses 24 to 27. Then it turns to the apostles from 28 down to 38. 28 down to 38. We see them give us a mixed example, I suppose. You could say the apostles there give us a mixed example of leadership. And then finally, 39 to the end. Don't write this down until I spell it for you. Again, it's the principal example, but it's the you know the high school principal, P-R-I-N-C-I-P-A-L. The principal example for us is the last section where Jesus gives us the par excellence. This is the principal example, the first and foremost, that we all look to in our leading, in our greatness. So it's a passage in three sections. The first is about the principle of leading well. The second is a mixed example given to us from the apostles. And the final section is our great leader himself shows us what to do. First of all, the principle there in verses 24 to 27. What does it look like? What's the shape of leadership look like? First thing to say here is that it's very un-Australian. Very un-Australian. Being great here is not poo-pooed. Being great here, there's nothing wrong with being great. In Australia, when the tall poppy grows and flowers, the rest of the country gets out the hacksaw and cuts them down very low. Anyone whose head goes above the dashboard in Australia, hack them down low very quick. Jesus has no problem here with being great. He does, though, tell us what it means to be great. Go for greatness, but a particular type of greatness, a type of greatness where you're not up there to be looked at and honoured and respected, but you're up there to serve everyone else below you, where you're suffering for the rest of the tribe. That's what it means to be great. It's pretty clear there in 26, not so with you. Let the greatest among you become as the youngest and the leader as one who serves. It's not saying don't lead. We need all of you to be leaders. In 2 weeks' time, as we preach the gospel on the campus, we need all of you to lead. But lead as serving others in a particular way. 27, who's the greater? The one who reclines at the table or the one who serves? It's not the one. Is it not the one who reclines at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. Jesus shows us that the serving of the other is his sort of leadership. The principle of leadership, it's about a lowerarchy, not a hierarchy. It's not a hierarchy where you climb the ladder to the top. It's a lowerarchy where you climb the ladder further down to carry the load. The key principle that we must wrestle with here is that our default position is that as soon as someone steps up, we immediately think they're going to have it easier there. They got this bunch of people here to serve them. Who thinks of leadership that way? Who thinks of the ladder that way? That's often how we think of the ladder. As you go up, easy street, because there's more minions to do your bidding. You're completely deceived. That is not the reality that you're going to face in the future. It's complete deception. The higher up you go, you don't get to stand on those guys and they push you up. It's more that you're there to pour yourself out for them. The service in the pyramid of management is not A serves B, B serves C as you go up the chain. It's actually the one above who keeps serving down. So as you climb the ladder, do so because you're not going to look at the higher ones up and, wow, spectacular honour, but go there because with a heart like Jesus Christ, you'll go there because it's a tough position and it'll cost your life, and everyone else below you needs you to serve there. This is the key principle for us to wrestle with here. To climb the ladder doesn't mean greater honour. You get to glow somehow. To climb the ladder means you're going to have to suffer for everyone else's sake. There's pressure on you. There's stress upon you. Some of you will see this in your families, mum and dad, grandpa, grandma. Life's tough where they are. They've got pressure on them in their workplaces, in their families, because the higher up, they're concerned for everyone else below. The higher you go, the greater is your concern for those for whom you're responsible. Jesus is commending to us here greatness, a greatness where you do become the great one because you're carrying the load for the rest. If you don't lock this in, it will ruin your marriage, it'll ruin your family, it'll ruin your understanding of church and leadership there, it'll ruin how you enter into the workplace. A godly husband is one who has the leadership but to sacrifice himself for her sake. He'll relate to her the way that she likes to be related to, because if someone's going to give up here, he gives up to serve her. He wears it for her sake. In church, submit to your elders because they're carrying the can for your sake. And when you get in their position, and for some of you it won't be long, they'll be, because you guys have been at uni and you've read the scriptures, you're the one who'll be leading at church. When you climb that ladder, you're the one who's going to be carrying the can for the rest. We must lock it in, first of all, to take that office and that position that's higher. You do so to serve. It's going to cost. You're going to have to trust God as you suffer for everyone else's sake. It's not about power. It's not about honour. It's about carrying the can for the rest of the world. Well, we have a mixed example that follows on. A mixed example of such leadership. Notice, first of all, it kicks off in a good way. These apostles in 28, Jesus, it's, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, something like that. The Last Supper has just wrapped, it's wrapping up now. Jesus has revealed the fact that one of the tables is going to betray him. He's spoken of his pouring in his blood, breaking his body. And this is the end of dinner conversation. By lunchtime the next day, he'll be crucified. Notice how he commends the apostles in 28. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials. They don't just get a bad rap. They've done the hard yards. They've stood with him with Pharisees taunting, they so on, and they've stood with him in the difficult times. And as the CEO passing on the job, he assigns to him a seal of approval. Here you go, you've got a kingdom. Here's your big bonus in the paycheck. I assign to you, as my father assigned to me, a kingdom that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. First of all, it gets up in a good footing. This apostle has actually done well in standing with Jesus in the task. But there's a foe on the loose. 31, Satan pops up. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you that he might sift you like wheat. But I prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. If I can turn this into Australian English, there's in 31, when it says Simon, Satan demanded to sift you, it's actually in the plural in the original Greek text. So it's Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded to, you know, to sift all of you. But I've, you know, prayed for you, Simon. So in Australia, to have, you know, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan's demanded to have yous, that he might sift yous like wheat. But I prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. So there's, you know, trouble on the horizon for this leadership succession group of the 12. Failure is coming. After failure, Peter is one who will be returned, maybe first, in a stronger way, and he'll strengthen the rest, and the rest, they'll then man up to do the succession well in Jesus' absence. Jesus goes on, Peter goes on, you know, Lord, you know, I'm ready to go with you both to prison, to death. He doesn't realise that he's going to deny Jesus. 34, Jesus says, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny me three times that you know me. Now a bit of a confusing part. Let's read on. We should focus on the sword. Been a few questions in Bible study groups this last week. What's with the swords? 35, he said to them, when I sent you out with no money bag or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything? They said, nothing. And he said to them, but now let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack. And let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you, the scripture must be fulfilled in me, and he was numbered with the transgressors. For what is written about me has its fulfillment. And they said, look, Lord, here are two swords. And he said to them, it is enough. What's going on in this little exchange between Jesus and Peter and the sword fighting on the side? I think one of the questions is it metaphorical? Is he really saying you need a sword, or pointing to something else? And also, if it is a real sword here, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Is it a good thing to have the swords or a bad thing to have swords? How should we react to the fact they're having swords? Are we happy about this? Are we sad about this? Are we frustrated? Are we annoyed? What's with the swords? I've got some thoughts. Anyone want to jump in from Bible study? Anyone got some options that you throw around? Just want to throw out there?
Can I also add as well that later on, we've read a little bit further, and it says just a bit later on that they use the swords, and he's like, what are you doing? Stop using the swords.
Yes.
And it was just
yes.
very confusing about what his intentions were.
Yes. One of them, was it Peter? He cuts off one of the servant's ears within a few verses. He uses one of the swords, and then Jesus whacks the ear back on.
Dust it off.
And why the swords? Other thoughts, questions? I'll jump in. I think this is a sign, and this is why I say that it's a mixed apostolic succession portrait at the moment. This is a bad sign about the apostles. Yes, they've stood in their trials. I think this is a sign that Satan is sifting them, and their faith is pretty much going. I think this is a sign here that already they have lost the plot, and rather than entrusting themselves to God, the only devices left to them are fight in the normal way that everyone else fights. Don't entrust yourself to God. Jesus is basically saying to these guys, look, in the past you trusted me. You went out with nothing and you were provided for. But now I can see that you guys don't trust me anymore. Slap on a sword. Do it your way, because it's the only thing you've got in you. That might be also behind why they've already got swords in 38. Oh, look, we found two. Here they are. That'll do. Where do those swords come from? It seems some say it was a custom to have a sword at a banquet, so they might have had to have one anyway, but Luke hasn't made any mention of this up to this point. Luke's just all of a sudden told us they've got two swords. That could point that they've already into the sword way of thinking before Jesus encourages them that way. I think this is a sad sign that the apostles have already deserted trust in God in their greatness, and Jesus is saying, well, you better sort up, because the ways of the world are the only things that you guys are appreciating now. When we get to next week, further in the passage, we see that they have all deserted Jesus Christ. But then we have the good example. I think what's left with us then is that there's one man left standing who actually is leading and great the way that God wants, and it's Jesus Christ himself. I think when you get to verse 39, Jesus Christ is the only one left. He came out and he went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. And here now we now see the principal example, the example par excellence of what it means to be great, Jesus Christ. When they came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and then knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, "Why are you sleeping? Rise and pray, that you may not enter into temptation." A little bit of Old Testament background for these verses. First of all, one we've glanced over in 37. He was numbered with the transgressors. Isaiah 53. Let me read it to you. Isaiah 53. What these verses bring together is what we looked at last week. Jesus Christ here is entrusting himself to God as he is going to now suffer everything for all of our sake. He's now bearing our sin for our sake and all of its consequences. Isaiah 53 verse 12, Isaiah writes, "Because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many." Little phrases speaking about Isaiah, this suffering servant who will come. Jesus here, with Luke quoting this verse about Jesus, Jesus is the suffering servant of Isaiah. And look what this Isaiah suffering servant does. He bears the sin of many and makes intercession to God for us, the transgressors. That's what's going down here. Jesus, the greatest one, is suffering all, even our sin and its consequences, that we might have forgiveness. And then in the cup in verse 42, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me." What's the cup going on about here? It's sort of the allotted portion to drink. The Old Testament cup spoken of was a cup of absolute destruction. There was a cup of destruction to come. In Isaiah 52, jot down Isaiah 52. I've lost the... 51:17. Isaiah 51 verse 17. "Wake yourself. Wake yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of his wrath." Who have drunk to the dregs, the bowl, the cup of staggering. Jeremiah, the Psalms speak of the same cup. Here, Jesus, in Gethsemane, he prays, not blood, but you know, it's like drops of blood coming out of him, because he knows the next day he's drinking this cup brooding with the wrath of God. And he's drinking it for you and for me and for Jerusalem and for Israel. Jesus is our greatest. He is the top of the pile. He's the one we all call Lord. And he shows us that as the Lord, he has suffered for the whole of the body, the whole of the organization, everyone below him. We honor him, the one who has borne all for all of our sake. He's our example. To climb the ladder means to bear more. He has drunk the cup for us all. Brothers and sisters, he's drunk it. It's gone. Down to its dregs. There's nothing for you to bear on the coming of the day of Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ has already, 2,000 years ago, drunk it all down. It's empty. It's gone. You might feel guilty at times. Look back to Jesus and remember the fact, despite how you're feeling, he's drunk it already. It's all gone. There is nothing before you and God anymore. In Isaiah 53, he has come and made intercession for us transgressors. He has borne the sins of... It has been borne, carried away once and for all through the death of Jesus Christ the next day on the cross. Let me finish with some reflections on being great and an invitation to you for greatness. Back in 28, the apostles, those are the ones who stayed with Jesus in his trials. The great lives that I pray many of you will live are lives that will be full of trials. That's why they'll be great. Your life will be difficult, it'll be full of trials, and that's why it will be great. In that context, reflecting upon greatness, entrust yourself to God when you go through the trials, and to be great by doing so. The apostles, and even Jesus himself here, had to entrust himself to God. Notice what happened. So Satan demanded to have them sifted. Jesus prayed, entrusting himself to God. Look at verse 43. There appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. Jesus is praying. Imagine being that angel. You're an angel sent to earth to strengthen Jesus Christ. What a ministering angel you would be, sent to strengthen God himself. What a privilege it would have been to be that angel. 43, and being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. He prayed and prayed and prayed more earnestly, entrusting himself to the God who strengthens him. If Jesus Christ needed to pray and be ministered to by an angel, how much more do you and me? How much more in our trials ought we entrust ourselves to our Heavenly Father? And the third reflection on greatness, it's going to be hard. Entrust yourself to God. The third reflection, it'll keep being hard. It won't lighten up. The difficulties will continue. But you'll be able to keep going because you'll be entrusting yourself to God. You'll have to persevere in suffering for others' sake. But you'll be full of faith, knowing that there is a God out there who strengthens you and pushes you on. An example of this, it's wonderful hearing Peter, the great failure here, who later turned and was able to strengthen the others. Wonderful hearing what Peter says about Jesus Christ later on in one of his letters. Later in years, he would write about the whole, what he saw and his own failure. In 1 Peter chapter 2, this is what Peter writes. It's a gracious thing when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. Hasn't he changed from here, where he's wielding the sword, chopping off ears, to a complete reversal down the track? Like Jesus Christ, he now has become one who, the difficulties come, I just walk forward and suffer them, entrusting myself to God. And he writes, Jesus committed no sin, deceit not found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he didn't revile. When he was suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. That's what, in his reflection, Peter was seeing in this passage here. At this point in time, he looks back, he sees Gethsemane, he sees Jesus Christ, unlike us, he just kept entrusting himself to God who judges justly. Though it was completely difficult, and he was suffering for others' sake. What about us? Who of you is going to be great? Who of us are going to be the great ones who suffer for what everyone else's sake here, and for the sake of the other Christians on the campus here, and Logan, and Macrobat, and South Bank, and the Gold Coast, and suffer here for the sake of the others who don't know Jesus Christ? Who among us here is going to entrust yourself to God as you suffer for everyone else's sake? You'll suffer socially, you'll suffer physically, some of you may end up having to suffer academically, you might suffer personally, you might suffer financially. who here is going to be great and suffer for everyone else's sake?